Good morning, everybody. James chapter 4, if you got your Bibles this weekend, and I hope that you brought them. James chapter 4. In James chapter 3 and 4, James discusses conflicts that are going on in the church. Apparently, these people to whom he was writing were a real piece of work because he doesn't pull any punches, as we have seen. In chapter 1, he accused them of being arrogant and weak-kneed and double-minded. In chapter 2, he accused them of prejudice and hypocrisy. And now in chapters 3 and 4, he accuses them basically of being a bunch of hard-hearted, self-centered, hateful jerks. That would be the original Greek, how we would translate that. We tend to look back on the early church and we think, oh, it must have been awesome back then with all of the holiness and the all-night prayer meetings and hobnobbing with the apostles. These chapters show you it was not always awesome. People back then were as difficult and as thorny as they are today. As James opens chapter 4, he poses a very, very simple thought question. It's very relevant to us today. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? One thing that we all have in common is that we experience conflict in relationships. This is what all marriages have in common. The one common denominator, conflict. I do not care how perfect that family looks on the outside. I promise you, they have conflict. People sometimes look at my beautiful, charming wife and assume that because I'm a pastor and because she is so awesome and so friendly and so easygoing that it is always sunshine, rainbows, and giggles over at the Greer house, or that when she and I do have a disagreement that we discuss the issue calmly, we quote some affirming scripture to each other, and then we end in prayer and a warm embrace. I can assure you that is not the case. Veronica and I assumed when we got married that we'd have an essentially friction-free marriage. True story, not exaggerating. When we did the session on conflict in our premarital counseling, we actually said to each other later, after the session, that felt totally irrelevant. Up until that point, y'all, we had never had a fight. Then we got married, and God took us through a deep dive practicum, a lab, if you will, in conflict those first 9 months or so. So we have known conflict in our family. In fact, y'all know that every single week I pray that God will make whatever passage that I'm preaching that week personally relevant to me, you know, just so I'm not up here sharing information, but really, you know, speaking out of what God is teaching me personally. And y'all, my wife is so in tune with the Spirit. And she loves me so much, and she is so dedicated to my preaching ministry that she made sure, and I contributed too, that we got to personally experience this week the verses that we're gonna study this week on quarrels and conflicts. And almost all of it happened over text, so you know it was healthy, okay? So what is the source of your conflict, James asks you. Now, I asked that, James asked that, and you say, well, easy. And you point to whomever you're having conflict with, and you say, they are. That's the source of my conflict. For those of you that are married, if I asked you to identify the main cause of your conflict in your life, that'd be dangerous. That'd be a dangerous question for me to ask. If I said, what causes conflict in your marriage? You would say, her or him. And then you'd start whispering and shaking your heads, and somebody would get up and walk out mad. Most of the unhappiness and strife and conflict in my life, you might say, is there because of you, spouse, because you don't think about my feelings and you don't think about my needs as much as you do yours. It's because of you, boss, because you never think about the implications that your decisions have on me, and you never seem to appreciate or recognize my efforts. It's because of you, child. You ungrateful, think you're smarter than the world, think the world revolves around you, child. It's because of you, mom or dad, because you try to control me too much. It's you, dude, who just cut me off in traffic because you assume that you're the only person on the road, you and that ridiculous jacked up pickup truck of yours that you think gives you the right to change lanes whenever you want. I may or may not be thinking about an actual event this week, okay? It's you, grocery store clerk. Could you possibly go any slower checking out those items? It's you, mom of one of the girls in my daughter's class who thinks your kid is so much better than everybody else and that you're the only one who actually knows how to parent. You catching my drift? You catch my drift? The reason I experience conflict, we think, is because of you. We say to somebody, you're the problem. James says, think deeper. Think deeper. Is it not true, he asks, is it not true that the real reason for conflict is that your passions are at war within you? You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and you cannot obtain, so you fight and you quarrel. Let me try to make that very simple. The reason you have conflict, James says, is you are not getting something that you want. You got something that you feel entitled to, some way that you wanted your day to go, and that person is keeping you from it. This is true, y'all, in even the most superficial of conflicts, right? I mean, I stayed at a hotel this week. I was on the road and I went to the gym for an early morning workout, which I love when I'm on the road because, you know, you gotta sit in board meetings all day, and not only is getting a good workout in, not only is it good for the body, but it's just a time I can put my headphones in, I can listen to a podcast or an Audible book, and I can just be quiet. But there was this guy next to me in this gym, this hotel gym, an older guy who was wearing all the tight, you know, way too tight muscle outfits. He's got the braces for his elbows and his knees. He's got the sweatband on his head. And you're like, I'm like, who carries all this stuff when they're traveling? And he is, y'all, when he is grunting and breathing and straining so loudly that I was genuinely annoyed. Just everything he did is totally unnecessary. It just sounded gross. And I could barely hear my podcast. It did not turn into anything, this incident, but I was very irritated. Now, what was I really mad about? What was I mad about? If he were doing that near somebody else, I would not have been so mad. But he was keeping me from the vision of how I had seen my morning going. And that's why I was mad. So you got conflict, James says, because somebody keeps you from something that you want. And your anger burns at them. And you resent them. And even, James says, you want to murder them. See, verse 2 again, you desire and do not have, so you murder. Now, some of you are like, all right, murder. Now you are talking about my family. By the way, James is writing to church people when he says this, not to people in prison. So murder here is metaphorical. He is talking about murder the way that Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount, where you rage at somebody and you desire to hurt them. Like I did the guy in the gym. I really wish this guy, Lord, would it be too much to ask that he'd pull a muscle right now? He'd drop a 45-pound plate on his head. Would that be too much? Right? It would serve him right, and I would get to finish my workout in peace. So James says, the rage in your heart comes from the fact that this person kept you from something that you wanted. Now, I know at this point you're like, well, wait a minute, Pastor. No, no, no. I get that. I get what you're saying, but this person really did do me wrong. My husband really was acting selfishly. Or maybe he cheated on me. Or that person genuinely disrespected me. Or they stole from me. Or they deprived me of something that I legitimately deserved. James is not denying that. But he is saying that the rage, the conflict came because they kept you from something that you wanted. And that, James says, actually points to the presence of two things in your heart that have nothing to do with that other person. And those two things are idolatry and a lack of trust in God. Now, stay with me here, okay? Because I'm telling you, if you can get this, what I'm about to say, what James is saying, it can unlock a door in your understanding of your own heart and help you understand why so many relationships often go sideways. The key is in that word covet in verse 2. You covet and you cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. Coveting is where we want something so badly that we think there is no possible way we could be happy or content without it. It's not that the desire or the thing that you desire is in and of itself wrong. It's usually not. In fact, the word passion in verse 1 does not point to a sinful passion. It's not usually something sinful that you desire. You have a desire, for example, for somebody to be on time. You have a desire that they be more thoughtful or to be less selfish or to be faithful to you or more attentive to your needs. And those are legitimate desires. But those desires have become demands. They've become cravings They become things you covet, which control your whole attitude and also determine how you feel about somebody else. Coveting is a kind of idolatry. James is going to make that connection explicit in verse 5. Idolatry is when you require something besides God and his will in order for you to be happy, satisfied, and content. You believe that you need this thing, whatever it is, or this state of things to be happy or content because you think that that's what you need to be happy. And because you think this person is keeping you from that thing, you rage at them. We have all kinds of legitimate desires, but nothing is supposed to control our hearts such that without it, we despair or we become deeply discontent or we rage at or hate somebody else. Our contentment and our peace and our joy is to be dependent on God alone, being in his will and in the knowledge of his presence in and control over our lives. So here's the question that you need to ask yourself. What is it that I want bad enough that I'm willing to yell at, tune out, abuse, or neglect to get? What is it in any conflict? This is what you gotta ask yourself. Anytime you feel rage and anger in your heart, what is it that I want so badly that I'm willing to yell at, tune out, abuse, or neglect to get that thing? Because these things point, James says, to the presence of an idol. And that is the real source of your conflict. St. Augustine said that emotions like rage or bitterness, they function like smoke from a fire. You can follow the trail of smoke back down to the fires in your heart, and they're usually fires that you have built in worship of a false idol. When you see smoke in your house, the last thing that you want to do is just get rid of the smoke. If I come home and my living room is filled with smoke, I don't say, "Whew, kids, open the windows and turn on the fans." No, more important than getting the smoke out of the house is figuring out what is causing that smoke. More important than learning to control your rage and your anger. Some of you have learned all kinds of coping techniques. More important than that is figuring out what's causing it in the first place. So just ask yourself, where are you bitter at your spouse? Where do you rage at a boss or a child or seethe toward a friend? They may be at fault. They may genuinely be at fault. But the rage and the bitterness point to a deeper problem in you. At the end of verse 2, James says, you do not have because you don't ask. Pray. Your first problem, he says, is that you've made the wrong person responsible for your needs. You're looking to somebody else to supply something that really only God can supply. Your horizontal conflicts come because of a vertical disruption. You don't trust God here, so you rage here. All right, this is about to get really deep. You ready? Heard a Christian teacher present this question one time this way. Has it ever occurred to you that what you crave, you're not getting because you're trying to squeeze it out of somebody who doesn't have it? Has it ever occurred to you that what you crave, you're not getting because you're trying to squeeze it out of somebody who doesn't have it? You want control. You want respect. You want significance and satisfaction. You want approval and belonging. What if the primary source of those things was supposed to be not your spouse, it was supposed to be God, not your friends, not your boss, not a big crowd, it was supposed to be him. And now you're looking to somebody else to give you what only he can give you. Has it ever occurred to you that what you crave, you're not getting because ultimately you're trying to squeeze it out of somebody who doesn't have it? I've told you before that many people approach marriage like a person drowning in a sea of loneliness and despair, or a sea of low self-esteem. And they see a marriage partner come along like a life preserver who can save them from all of those things. Here you got a guy drowning in life. He's got all kinds of emotional dysfunctions. He's completely unhappy being single. He's miserable. He's lonely. He's purposeless. He's wandering, he's unhappy. He cannot imagine being happy or feeling complete in his life as a single man, even if that's God's will for him for a while. And as he is drowning in this ocean of purposelessness, along by floats a 5'2" blonde-headed life preserver with beautiful eyes and a gray body. So what does he do? He clings to her and he sucks the life out of her. And when she disappoints him or lets him down, which she inevitably will, he rages at her. What if she was not designed to supply all those things? Here's what I've learned after 23 years of observing marriages in this church. Lonely, insecure single people in Raleigh and Durham become lonely, insecure married people. In fact, they usually get worse. If you are unhappy as a single person, you will be unhappy as a married person because that spouse cannot make you happy, because problems like loneliness and insecurity are not cured by another human being. They're only cured by the love of God. They cannot give you that sense of identity or security or significance or approval. They can't meet all of your needs. They weren't designed to. And here's the thing, when something you idolize disappoints you, you demonize it. You rage at it. Remember this, whatever you idolize, one day you will demonize. Has it ever occurred to you that what you crave, you're not getting because you're trying to squeeze it out of somebody or a group of people who just don't have it? I've sometimes said that I wish when I'm doing a marriage ceremony that I could take a Sharpie and draw on the forehead of both spouses before they walk down the aisle a little sign that says, "Will not support the weight of your soul." Like one of those signs you might see in front of a bridge in a rural area that says max 2 tons, which means you can drive your bike across this bridge, you can walk across it, you might be able to drive a Prius across it, but if you try to drive a dump truck across this bridge, it will crumble and you will end up in the creek. This bridge was not built to support that kind of weight. Marriage can be a wonderful addition to your life, but it cannot meet the deepest needs of your soul. And if you depend on it for that, it will crumble underneath you. Has it ever occurred to you that what you crave, you're not getting because you're trying to squeeze it out of somebody who doesn't have it? Y'all, that's true not just in marriage. I'm merely using that as an illustration. That's true in any relationship. So again, let's go back to that first question. What is it that I want badly enough in my life that I'm willing to yell at, tune out, abuse, or neglect to get? Those things point to the presence of an idol, and that's your real problem, James says. Now, y'all, that by itself will be enough for us to think about for the rest of the day, rest of the week, maybe rest of the month, right? We can just close the Bible and go home thinking about how terrible we all are and how worthy we are of all those names that James calls us. But James, as we would expect, is not done. James sees us doubled over in pain, and so he decides, oh, now it's time to twist the knife a little further. So he says, verse 3, remember we ended verse 2 by saying you don't have because you don't ask. Now he says, verse 3, but actually you ask, you pray, but you still don't receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. In other words, you've tried to turn God into a genie who exists to fulfill your covetous passions. Then he says, verse 4, you adulterous people. Now, this is an interesting and honestly quite disturbing metaphor. James says, some of you do ask God to meet your needs, but he's not answering you because you're praying like an adulterer. So pray tell, you ask, how does one pray like an adulterer? Well, think about it. What is adultery? Adultery is when one spouse finds certain delights in somebody else that they ought to be finding in their spouse. It's not that the desire for romantic or sexual intimacy is wrong. It's that desiring it with this other person is wrong because I've already covenanted it with somebody else. You are not enough for me romantically and sexually, I am saying to her. I need somebody else. Spiritual adultery is when you find the happiness and security that you ought to find in God, you find that in something or someone else, or you seek it in something or someone else. Adultery in the Bible is always a metaphor for idolatry. Spiritual adultery is when we look to something or somebody else for what we should be finding in God. Does it make sense? Praying like an adulterer means asking God to become complicit in your idolatry. It means praying with the conviction that unless God supplies this thing that you're asking for, you could never be happy or content in life. And God says, but you're supposed to be happy and content just trusting in me and resting in my presence and in my will for your life. Imagine if a man said to his wife one night over dinner during their date night, hey, when we got married, we set our vows, you promised to fulfill my romantic and sexual needs. And so I have a request. She's nervous. She's like, I don't quite remember exactly a phrase like that, but go on. And so he proceeds to tell her that he is determined that what he needs to be romantically and sexually fulfilled is for her to arrange a sexual liaison with her friend so-and-so. That date night is not gonna end well, am I right? If a man actually did that, it would be heartbreaking to his wife, right? She would say, when I made that vow, I meant I myself would be your romantic and sexual fulfillment, not that I would be your pimp to arrange that with other people. When we ask God for something and our happiness and our contentment and our emotional equilibrium are dependent on him giving us the answer that we are demanding, that is, we could not imagine being happy without that thing we're asking for, we pray like an adulterer. Do you see that? Because we are seeking a happiness, a contentment, and a security in some thing that we ought to be finding in God. God, I need this raise. Because God, without this financial raise, I can't be happy or satisfied. I won't be secure. I won't have a great future. There's nothing wrong with the request for a raise. The problem is that you've made your happiness and contentment dependent on getting it. Oh God, please fix my spouse. Please fix him. Please fix her. Make them more attentive to my needs. Nothing wrong with the request. What's wrong is that you think you'll never live a full, happy life until they're different. God, I need to make this team. I need to get this award. God, I've got to get into this school because I can't feel good about myself unless I do. God, I need a boyfriend or I need a girlfriend or God, I need to get married because without marriage, I won't feel complete in life. And God says, you adulterer. You're asking me to supply in somebody else what you ought to be finding in me. You should be able to be happy and content and complete with me. It's not that you shouldn't have those other desires. They're fine. It's that you should still be able to be content with me and not covet those things. Your anger, your rage at others, and really first at God, James says ultimately, goes down to idolatry. Your conflict and your rage are like smoke from a fire that you can trace back to the altars that you have erected in worship of a false idol. Your intimate conflicts ultimately come from idolatrous cravings. Your intimate conflicts ultimately come from idolatrous cravings. So what's the solution? Y'all, what's the solution? Before I tell you what James says the solution is, could I just point out one of the things that I love about James? Is that he does more than just tell you that you got a problem and then call you a bunch of nasty names and then tell you to go fix yourself. No, he diagnoses the problem, showing you the problem behind the problem, and then shows you how to fix that problem at the source, which is so much more helpful than a lot of the other diagnostic instruments in my life, right? Like the little check engine light in my car. Could I just rage about that for a minute? My second daughter just left for college. She's a freshman now at NC State, so I inherited her car back. And when I got into it to drive it for the first time in a long time, I immediately noticed the check engine light was on with a little illuminated wrench underneath, which prompts two questions. Number one, how long has that thing been on? Number two, check what about the engine? Clearly it's telling me to take a wrench to something, but what? So being obedient, I dutifully pull the car over, I open the hood, I stand in front of the engine to check engine. And my first thought standing there is, man, there is a lot of stuff in here. But here was the most frustrating part. There's no tiny flags waving with a little arrow pointing to something saying, twist wrench here, twist wrench here. Within moments, I had determined beyond any reasonable doubt that the level of the windshield wiper fluid was fine, okay? I even glanced around the engine for dead animals. Check fans for dead little rats, if you remember from last week. Even sniffed a little, right? Just to see, right? And then, well, that's all I knew how to do. It said check engine, I checked engine. And then, confident that I'd done whatever it was telling me to do, I got back into my car and went on my way, right? Ultimately, I'm taking somebody else to get them to check the engine. James is much more helpful than that kind of indicator light. In verses 6 through 10, he gives you a number of instructions about how to deal with your idolatrous heart. Number of instructions, but I think I can summarize them in two basic categories, okay? Here's category number one. Humble yourselves, verse 10. Humble yourselves, verse 10. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. In context, these verses like these are often lifted out of context. In context, humble yourselves means two things. There'll be an A and a B. A, humble yourselves by acknowledging that there may be good reasons God is withholding from you something that you desire. That's the first place you humble yourself. Psalm 84:11 promises us that no good thing will he withhold from those who walk uprightly before him, which means if it is truly good for me, God will not withhold it. He will supply it. No good thing will he withhold. And if he does withhold it, that can only mean it must not ultimately be good for me at this particular time. You are mad because you thought you needed this, and that person is not giving it to you. But humble yourselves that you may not know what is best for your life, and a sovereign God is guiding your life who promises that no good thing will he withhold from those who walk uprightly. I thought I needed the marriage. I thought I needed the win, the raise, the acceptance, the contract, the healed body, but you didn't give it to me, God. So you must have a better plan. This week, I was listening to an old talk by Elizabeth Elliot. She was the missionary whose husband, along with four other young missionaries, was speared to death along the beaches of Ecuador in the 1950s. In this talk, she said that the hardest thing to do is to trust God when his plan goes 180 degrees opposite the way that you thought it should go. Have you been there? She and Jim, her husband, had trusted God with their relationship when they were dating. When they graduated from Wheaton College, they were in love, but they waited 5 years to get married because they both felt led to serve God on the mission field in two different places. She in Africa and he in South America, and they sensed this so strongly, they knew it meant they had to wait on getting married if they would ever get married at all. So they waited 5 years. Eventually, God led them back together and they got married. They were married for 2 years, less than 2 years, when Jim was speared to death, taking the gospel to this remote tribe there in Ecuador. She said the night before Jim and the other four men left to make this initial contact with this very hostile tribe, they had all knelt down, they had prayed, and she said, we ended our prayer time by singing a hymn that had the words, "We rest on thee, our shield and our defender." And then the next day, Jim left in obedience, and God, his shield and defender, let him be speared to death. Elizabeth Elliot asked this group of college students in this talk that I was listening to, she said, will you trust God when he leads you there? Will you trust your shield and defender when he lets the spears penetrate your chest? Then she said, because God is God, he is worthy of my trust and obedience. Therefore, I will find rest nowhere but in his holy will that is unspeakably beyond my largest notions of what he is up to. Humility. God's got a different plan than me, and when his plan goes 180 degrees opposite of what I want or where I think it should go, I'll trust him. I'll trust him, and when it doesn't make sense, I'm still gonna trust that Psalm 84:11 is true, that no good thing is he withholding. And if he's withholding it, it must not ultimately be good for me. Humble yourselves by admitting there may be good reasons God is withholding from you something you desire. Verse 7, submit yourselves therefore to God and trust him. That's the first way you humble yourselves. The second way you humble yourselves, letter B, humble yourselves by admitting your idolatrous desires are a major contributor to this conflict. You got to humble yourself by admitting that idolatrous desire is a major contributor to this conflict. The other person may be at fault, but the reason that you're so angry, the reason you rage and seethe and struggle with bitterness is because your idolatrous heart has latched onto something other than God that you think is necessary for happiness and for contentment. Admit that to yourself and then confess it to God. That's what James is getting at in verse 8. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. And purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. I mean, y'all, clearly James is an Enneagram 8. Can we all at least agree on that? I get in trouble sometimes for saying overly direct things, but y'all, I'm a kitten compared to James. Let's just acknowledge that. Before you confront the other person about anything, look in the mirror and say, it's me. Hi, I'm the problem, it's me. At tea time, everybody agrees, okay? Humble yourself. Like a third of you are like, I understand what he's saying there. Two thirds of you are like, what is he talking about, okay? Then, if appropriate, ask your teenager. If appropriate, confess your idolatry to the other person also. This is hard, y'all. Acknowledge to them that your anger, at least in part, arises from your own messed up heart. And that will be hard. Oh, because you want to excuse yourself and blame all your anger on them. And here's what you think. If you confess your part in the conflict, you feel like you're going to be letting them off the hook. And then they're going to use your confession against you. But that's not true. I know a marriage counselor who says that during marriage counseling, he will often draw a circle on a piece of paper. He said, this circle right here represents all your marriage problems, all your conflicts. Then he hands both of them a pencil, two different circles. He says, I want you to take this pencil and draw a slice in that circle that represents your part of the conflict. Maybe you got just a little bit, maybe it's just 1%. He says, in all my years of marriage counseling, there's never been a time when the husband or wife wouldn't draw even a teensy little slice in the circle. He would say, well, if you take a slice, you gotta be nice, because you're part of the problem. He said that whenever they would do that, whenever the husband and wife would do that, he said the temperature in the room would most always change. When both sides take some ownership, we're usually ready to begin moving forward. But we are hesitant to do that. We are hesitant to admit our part in the conflict, because when you admit you're part of the problem, you feel like you're losing your leverage. If I admit that I'm at fault in any way, I'm gonna lose my lofty platform from which I can rail against you about your issues. Well, first, y'all, you just gotta trust God with that. God tells you to deal with your junk first and to trust him with your spouse or whomever else you're in conflict with. Don't worry about being vindicated. Don't worry about losing your leverage. See how it says, verse 10, humble yourself, and who will exalt you? God will exalt you. If I humble myself by confessing my sin, God will exalt. God will vindicate me. I don't need to worry about vindicating myself or you exalting me by acknowledging my rightness in this disagreement we're having. God's gonna handle that. So I can just admit where I'm wrong and trust God and move forward. Second, why are you worried about losing your leverage? I mean, think about it. Have you ever really won an argument at home? I don't mean have you ever out-debated your spouse or your sibling, but have you ever really been in a big finger-pointing argument and really won in a way that brought peace and resolution? Most importantly, y'all, I've seen this approach of humbling yourself resolve more conflicts than any other. It's like a key that unlocks a door. When one partner in a conflict admits their part rather than reducing leverage, that humility usually opens up the other person to begin to admit theirs. Now, I do want to give one very important caveat here. There are certain kinds of people who are very skilled manipulators, who can, through things like gaslighting and victim shaming, they can cover up their abusive and manipulative behavior by always making you feel like their abuse, their sin is your fault. I am not talking about that. If you're in that kind of relationship, or you think you might be in that kind of relationship, you need to go see a Christian counselor immediately. I'm talking about this in the context of the normal rumble-tumble of conflict. Y'all, imagine if the next time you're fighting with somebody, right in the middle of it, you went, well, you know what the real problem here is? The real reason I'm upset is because I crave something really, really badly, and I'm not getting it. What do you think would happen? By the way, y'all, I got a giggle thinking about how James must have processed all this and came up with his wisdom. Maybe this will make you more sympathetic with how blunt James is. I've never read this in a commentary, but I think it just makes sense. Think about this. James was Jesus' half-brother. Remember that? He probably grew up sharing a room with Jesus. Can you imagine? You might think it would be awesome if your brother was the Son of God. But the downside was, in any conflict, you were wrong. Every single time they're screaming, coming from the back bedroom, Joseph walks in, ignores Jesus, and goes right at James, because there's no way it could be Jesus' fault, right? So James is like, listen, I learned whenever I had conflict with my big brother, it was always me. But I learned a lot through that. Maybe you should do the same. So here's my question. Are you willing to try that? Anytime you're mad, to say, I'm gonna ask what these angry emotions indicate about what I'm yearning for, what I'm coveting over, where I'm an idolater. Here's how it went down for me not long ago. I get home from a business trip. I'm tired. I'm trying to be a good dad, focus on the kids. My wife, of course, has been single parenting for a couple of days, and she slips in something about a commitment that I had made for both of us the next night that I had not told her about. There was nothing outrageous about what she said. She was just surprised by something she thinks that I've sprung on her. My response was swift and decisive. I did tell you about that. She says, no, you didn't. At this point, still calmly, but now a bit more firmly, I insisted that I had indeed told her, as I do every time with every commitment. At this point, there's a little chill in the air, right? And we dropped it. Then later, after the kids had gone to bed, she brought it back up and said, I just feel like lately you've not been telling me your plans or checking with me to consider what's best for the family. Now, I sincerely wish I could tell you that I was humble, that I was skeptical of my own heart, and I had communicated eagerness to understand things from her point of view and learn from her observations. Alas, that is not what I did. I don't like being called thoughtless, and I definitely don't like being called irresponsible, especially when I feel like I busted my tail to get home from this trip early to spend time with the kids. I deserve to be commended, not criticized. So instead, I turned into lawyer JD, proving that my client, which is myself, was guilty of no charges and should be swiftly acquitted. My wife is, of course, frustrated because, for whatever reason, she feels like she's being left out and is not being communicated to, but my pride is hurt, and I really want to be honored as a thoughtful husband. So pretty soon, I'd move beyond litigation, and since she was not honoring myself, I started to honor myself. I actually said something like, I just don't see how we wouldn't default to me in this situation. After all, I'm a professional communicator, right? And somehow, I didn't say this was exemplary. I'm just telling you, okay? Somehow that led to me pointing out that I'd never be able to effectively run a staff of 300 people if I don't know how to communicate. And thus the size of our church proves that I'm right and she's wrong. And somehow that led to my college GPA, which I'm still not quite certain how we got there. And then I shifted into historian mode and took us on a brief journey through our marriage, highlighting a number of cogent illustrations that prove that I am the most communicative husband of all time, okay? At which point she said, you're right, babe. I just had not considered the bigger picture. Thank you for patiently correcting me. No. This ended with me in the other room on my iPad watching a show, wishing that my hard work as a husband were more acknowledged. Wouldn't it be so much better to not depend on Veronica or anybody else for vindication and just acknowledge how frustrating it is for her to not to be aware of something, to give her the benefit of the doubt, to listen to her frustrations and promise to do my best to keep her in the loop. It is because I crave vindication that this conflict ended with me seething in the other room rather than being a simple discussion between loving partners about how to better communicate. My pride and my idolatry made this conflict 10 times worse than it ever needed to be. One Christian counselor said this, no matter the duration, no matter the intensity, the severity, or subject matter, the solution is always found in James 4:10, humble yourselves before the Lord. And he will lift you up. And always remember this, verse 7, God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. If you want God on your side in a conflict, humble yourself before him and before others. If you want him as your enemy, exalt and vindicate yourself. He opposes the proud, but he gives grace to, he exalts the humble. And you also, when my wife and I have conflicts now, I always want to be the first one to apologize so then I can be like, God's on my side now. You better get yourself together, okay? Number two, draw near to God. Draw near to God. Verse 8 says, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Y'all know, as harsh as James is, you should recognize that behind these words, he's pointing you to the tender, compassionate love of God drawing you back. After James unloads on you, calling you adultering, wretched, double-minded, unstable sinners who should be mourning and not laughing, he just says, but he gives more grace than what? More grace than your sin, no matter how bad your sin is, he gives more grace. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you evokes the image of the father and the prodigal son story. Just waiting. Just waiting. Saying, just take a step toward me. Just take a step toward me, and I will run faster than you've ever seen a grown man run. Longing for his child to come home. The moment he sees you coming back, lifts up the corners of his robe and runs towards you. You have run off to the far country of anger, and it has wrecked your life. You're in the far country of bitterness. You got bitterness issues going back 2 and 3 decades in your marriage, in your family, with something that happened. God wants to restore you to his house of peace and joy and contentment. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. That evokes images of a God who so loved the world that he came to die on a cross for your sin, who would literally go through hell itself to bring you back. He didn't want heaven without us. So he brought heaven near, even though it meant enduring hell in our place so that he could bring us to heaven and bring heaven to us. This is the God who yearns for us to come back to him. In fact, he even uses conflicts in our lives to do that. This might be a radical thought, but what if through that conflict, God was saying to you, hey, the security you're looking for, the significance you crave, the assurance that you yearn for, that everything is gonna work out for good, that thing that you want so badly, that's not in that person. Your boss doesn't hold that key. Your friends don't hold that key. Your girlfriend doesn't hold that key. That's in me. I'm the comfort you're looking for. I'm the security you're looking for. I'm the significance. I'm the God who can sustain you and satisfy you. I loved you when you were running away from me. I sacrificed my life to make you my child. And now I promise to sovereignly control all things for your good and my plan in your life. That's what he's doing in you during conflict. So what if this week, whenever you feel anger or rage or bitterness or self-pity, you humble yourself and you ask yourself, where does this point to idolatry in my heart? What is it that I want bad enough that I'm willing to yell at, tune out, abuse, or neglect, or be bitter at somebody for years to get? And then you draw near to a God who's drawn near to you. You find that satisfaction and contentment and security and safety in the arms of a God who can fulfill you and sustain you more than any friend, parent, spouse, teammate, or coach ever could. Like I said, this for some of y'all, this goes back years. This humbling yourself and finding your contentment and identity and happiness in God, it can set you free from this self-imposed prison you're in. This is gonna set you free like nothing else you've ever been able to. Why don't you bow your heads if you would? Why don't you humble yourself right now? God, your plan's better than mine, so whatever I'm not getting in my job and my marriage and life, ultimately, it's good because no good thing will he withhold. Can you humble yourself that way? Can you humble yourself by saying, God, I'm the problem. And a lot of my conflict, I'm the problem. For some of you, you need to begin a relationship with Jesus Christ right now. You see, the gospel is that God loved you so much that he came to earth to restore you to himself. He died on the cross to pay for your sin, so that you could become his child again. Everything in your life that you felt you were missing, all the ways that you felt incomplete, it's because ultimately you were apart from him. And he offers that to you right now if you'll receive it by believing in Jesus and receiving him as your Savior. If you've never done that, do it right now. Jesus, I receive you. I accept you as my Lord and Savior. Let's linger here for just a moment as the Holy Spirit does his work. And then in just a moment, our worship teams, our campus pastors, they'll come. And they'll lead us to continue to engage with God.